Welcome to the Wellsteading Podcast. This is episode 30. It's September 25th, 2014. I'm your host, John Pugliano. Welcome back to another episode where we help you develop the Wellsteading lifestyle. Money may not buy happiness, but it can buy freedom, and that's what this podcast is all about. I had mentioned in a previous episode that today we would answer listener questions about mortgages. Well, I'm going to postpone that for an episode or so, and the reason for that is because the markets have fallen drastically today. And I'd like to just put out a special episode to talk about that. So we'll be doing a market review. Before we get started, again, want to welcome all the new listeners. I see that we're attracting more and more listeners every day. The show doesn't have any kind of marketing budget. I'm not going out of my way or doing anything special to market the show. We're in about our 10th week now, so we're beyond the 8-week grace period that iTunes gives you when they highlight the podcast. So we're not getting any new listeners coming in from that. So I can only assume that the only reason people are finding us is because all of our old current listeners, all of you charter members, you've gone out, told your friends, and you're spreading the word about the Wellsteading Podcast. Again, I can't thank you enough for that. This is a labor of love for me. I'll do my best to keep producing audio content that I think is relevant and will help you on your journey towards wealth and independence. And as I always say, each of these podcasts is going to relate back to the 10 wealth building principles. So if you haven't listened to the first 10 episodes, go back and do that. That's going to lay the foundation down for you. That's how I've lived my life. I can't guarantee that you'll be wealthy from doing that. I can't make any promises. I'm a registered financial advisor, but I can't give any advice or specific recommendations over this podcast. This podcast is meant in no way to represent advice or recommendations. It's strictly educational and a way for me to express my opinions. So listen to those 10 wealth building principles, study them, apply them in your own life, and then draw your own conclusions. I do want to give a special shout out to a listener. She's a great friend of the podcast. Her name is Natil. She's not only given the show a great rating, but she's taken the time to share it with her Facebook friends, and that's something I wanted to comment on. First of all, I really want to thank Natil for doing that. I've mentioned in previous podcasts that I don't use a lot of social media. In many ways, that's because I'm constrained by the SEC and state regulations as to what I can do and what would be construed as me promoting myself with testimonial advertising, things of that nature. Believe it or not, if I had a Facebook page and a client liked me on that, that could be considered a testimonial advertisement. That's illegal. I could lose my license. I could be fined. I could even be imprisoned. I know that's kind of funny when you think about it, because remember, Bernie Madoff ran the world's largest Ponzi scheme for 25 years. He never failed an audit, but I guess that was because he didn't have a Facebook page. Anyways, I am restricted from those type things, but you as listeners are not, and I'm not telling you what to do. You're adults. If you want to share things on Facebook or Pinterest, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever social media you use, I would be appreciative of that. That would be fantastic. Feel free to tell people about the show, send them a specific episode. Obviously, by you doing that, it's going to help build this community. It's going to help promote this podcast. But more importantly, I would think that you're doing it because the content of this podcast is helping that person you're sending it to. Maybe it's a relative. Maybe it's a friend. It could be someone struggling, trying to figure out how to get out of debt, or a young couple trying to learn how to build their assets. It could also be a very wealthy person that doesn't know what to do with their money. It's about helping people learn that wealth is a lifestyle. And we're responsible for it ourselves. It's not the government. It's not our employer. It's nobody else's responsibility but yours. So a shout out and special thanks again to Natil. I owe you a Cajun lunch. So let's get right into the episode and what the heck is wrong with the markets. As I mentioned, all the major indexes, it looks like they've crashed through their 50-day moving average. That's a real concern. That's the thin ice I've talked about. Today, it looks like the NASDAQ was down about 2%. The other major indexes, the Dow, the S&P 500, about 1.5, 1.6%. So these are pretty significant moves. I'm doing this episode right after the market closed, so I don't necessarily have firm numbers. I'm not 100% sure about volume, but it does look like to me, particularly on the NASDAQ, that again, this was not only a big drop, like I say, about a 2% drop on the NASDAQ, but also in higher than above average volume. That's been the theme all year. If you read my blog over at investablewealth.com, that's under the tab of observations and commentary, you'll see that I've been very concerned where I think that perhaps the institutional investors, the smart money, the hedge funds, maybe they've seen a market top and they've been getting out. Whenever people are coming in buying on the dips this year, I don't know. I have no way of knowing for sure. But what I can watch is the charts. And when I see the market moving up under smaller volume or smaller lower trade each day, when the price of the stocks or the price of an index has a drastic drop, and that's when there's a huge amount of selling volume, that tells me that people are taking profits. They're not buying when it's going up, but yet they're selling heavily when it's going down. It looks like that happened again today. This has been a very unstable and volatile market over the last 8 weeks or so. And again, if you're following me over at investablewealth.com, you see some of the graphs or some of the charts that I've used over there and the comments I've made on it. Now, does today's plunge through the 50-day moving average, does that mean that we're headed for the market to completely roll over and we're going to get a 10 or 15 or 20% correction? I have no way of knowing, and neither does anybody else. I've been concerned for at least the last 6 months because it kept looking to me like we were having a market top, but people did keep coming in and buying on the dips. So I've been wrong. I could be wrong again. I have, again, no way of knowing. I just want to express my opinion that I have concerns. And again, you can draw your own conclusions from that. If you've been listening to this podcast and reading my blog posts, you know that I've been concerned. You know that I've made a high cash position, that I believe that going to cash is a strategy. And for this year, I have been a very big proponent of the U.S. dollar. That was flat for a lot of the year, but the dollar is moving up. It's moved for about the last 6 weeks or so. And as I've mentioned recently, that too could have a drag on the U.S. market. U.S. exporters' products become more expensive. Big U.S. corporations that operate overseas, those profits that they make overseas can become devaluated because of lowering currency exchange rates. Is that what's driving the drop in today's market? I don't think so. Generally, I don't think there's ever one specific event, unless it's like a major terrorist attack or some big act of war, some act of nature that could plunge the market. Generally in the markets, it's been my experience that it isn't just one domino that falls that knocks everything else over. It's a series of problems. It's the iceberg under the water that you don't see that now becomes evident to everyone. It's that house of cards that has structural instability. And maybe no one event makes it fall over. It just falls from its own weak nature. That could be what we're currently seeing. Again, across the globe, there's no shortage of problems. Problems in the Middle East continue. They've escalated all year. We're sending troops back into Iraq. We're bombing in Syria. There's the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian fighting. Russia's fighting with its neighbors. We've had the Crimean incident going on for about, 6 to 8 months now. Sanctions on Russia. Russia's retaliation back to the European countries. The European economy weakening, if not stalling, perhaps moving into recession. The European ECB, the European Central Bank, talking about devaluating their currency, easing their money policies. Japan's Prime Minister Abe, he's been devaluating their currency for, maybe 2 years now, raising taxes, doing all the wrong economic things. Japan itself has been in a downward, deflationary cycle for the last 25 years. Abe's pulling out all the stops. He can't change course there. We're seeing slowdowns in China. Last year, we saw some changes in Chinese political leadership, but there's no real change there. They're continuing to inflate the housing bubble. They keep a double set of books. No one's really sure what's going on with the economy, other than the fact that we know that it's not growing in double digits like it had been. We see the same thing in the other supposed growing economies, places like Brazil, India. They've all had a hard time. No doubt that, yes, the U.S. economy has gotten better, but remember, it has gotten better that over the last 6 or so years, the Federal Reserve balance sheet has grown by well over $4 trillion. The Obama administration over the last 6 years has pumped in something on the neighborhood of $7 or $8 trillion. I've lost track of, and that would be debt. That's how much they've added to our national debt. And remember, this podcast, we're bipartisan when it comes in not trusting politicians. George Bush had added, $6 trillion to the deficit, something like that. Since 2000, the U.S. dollar, our currency, has been emaciated. We've tacked on so much debt to try and recover from things like terrorist attacks and internet bubbles, housing bubbles, on and on. Although it's gotten better because it's been built on a house of cards. It's funny money. Now, that doesn't mean you can't profit from it. I personally have made a lot of money over the last 14 years. And again, that's one thing I want to emphasize to you in this podcast. When we talk about building wealth, if our government is debasing the currency, if our government is running up debts, if our government is engaging in ridiculous wars, those are things that we can't control. They're out of our sphere of influence. We don't need to worry about them and get all frustrated and let that cloud our thinking. What we need to focus on is building up our own production capabilities, increasing our own talents, extending our networks, growing our families and our friendships. We need to figure out how to create these small businesses or position ourselves as valuable employees so no matter what happens, we're earning a solid income, we're saving, and we're investing. We don't care what's going on in the White House. We're concerned what's going on in our house. But I digress. Let's get back to the stock market. That's the concern at hand right now. And as I said, I don't think it's any one single event. Sure, Apple stock is down today because there might be some glitches with their software, maybe some problems with the new iPhone, but that's not the one trigger event. That's not the one problem. There are a series of systemic problems that could cause this market to falter. Now, will the government come back in to prop it up? They very much could. That's what's been happening for the last 6 years. That's why buying on the dips has been beneficial. But you have to remember, there's been a significant run-up, particularly in the last 2 years. They may not be able to pull things out of a tailspin. And in some cases, as I've mentioned in some of my other articles, they may not even want to. The Federal Reserve's main agenda is to take care of its member banks. They're more concerned about maintaining their own liquidity and maintaining their real estate and holding prices than they are in the overall economy. That's just my opinion. I don't necessarily think that the member banks of the Federal Reserve have an interest to keep the stock market growing. I believe they're more concerned about their deposits and how those can be invested in the future. A crash in the market may not be something that concerns them, particularly if they've been selling over the last 12 months, and we have no way of knowing. So is there danger ahead? Well, I don't know, but I think you should always be cautious and always be concerned about danger. Again, that's why I am not a proponent of buy and hold. I'm a proponent of buy and sell. If I can buy a stock or an exchange-traded fund and hold it for a couple weeks or a couple months and sell it at a profit, I try and do that. I don't get greedy. I generally take my profits at least by 20%. If I'm concerned about the volatility of a market, I have no problem taking a 2 or 3% profit. And I certainly try and cut my losses short. You may say, well, why would you make a trade and only make a 2 or 3% profit? Well, if you consider the low interest rate market that we're currently in, 10-year government treasuries, they're only yielding about 2.5, 2.6%. That's considered guaranteed money. It's the best guarantee in the world. So if you have to tie your money up with the federal government for 10 years to get, say, a 2.5 or a 2.6 return on your money, if you can make one stock transaction in the course of the year and increase the value of your portfolio by 3% and then never trade again for the rest of the year, well, you just locked in a better return and a more guaranteed return than the 10-year treasury because you didn't have to tie your money up for 10 years. You have no exposure to interest rates at that point because you're in cash. It just makes sense. As you begin to trade, as you learn to trade, don't be greedy. Take your profits when you can get them, particularly in turbulent markets. Something else I want to highlight in this podcast, and it's about mutual fund managers and other types of fund managers that are constrained from doing certain things. In particular, they're constrained from using the strategy that I just told you about going to cash. You see, if you see storm clouds ahead, you know to get out an umbrella or put on your raincoat or stay in the house that day. That's common sense. Now, you would do the same thing in the stock market. If you see storm clouds ahead in the economy, you could sell your stocks and go to cash. Historically, you may have even gone to bonds, but because the Federal Reserve has manipulated the bond rates so badly, particularly over the last 6 years, and we have historically low bonds and bonds that are probably artificially too low, at this point, again, in my opinion, I haven't even felt that bonds are safe. Remember, the price of a bond is inversely proportional to interest rates. When interest rates are low, bond prices are high. So in a market of declining interest rates, your principal grows if you're in a bond fund. But now that we're in historically low rates and possibly artificially induced low rates, should those rates start to be going up, if the yield is going up, you could lose your principal in a bond fund. That's something you should be aware of. And again, why I haven't been a fan of bonds over the last, say, 12 to 24 months. It's just the uncertainty driven by the Federal Reserve and their policies. So to get back to this point about fund managers and the constraints on them, if they see storm clouds ahead in the economy, they can't just pull in their horns and get out of stocks. Many of these fund managers are restricted from doing that by the mandates of their portfolio. I mean, obviously, for example, if it's an S&P 500 fund, they can't pull out of the S&P 500 because they have to remain 90 or 100% invested to mimic the performance of the S&P 500. If the S&P 500 drops 20%, they have to drop 20%. Now, if you're in an index fund, you understand that. But many people, many investors come to me and they say that they think they'll be protected because they're in a managed fund. They'll say, well, hey, I'm in a managed mutual fund. This portfolio has been managed by the same manager for the last 10 years, and he's returned a 12% rate of return over 12 years. Well, see, that may be true, but if we're going into a bad market and he's constrained by his prospectus as to what he can and can't do in that fund, let's say he has to remain 80% or 85% invested in stocks, even though He knows that we're headed for bad times. He can't sell and go to cash. He can only go 10 or 15% of his holdings into cash. He has to stay in equities. That's mandated by his prospectus. That's the governing laws of the portfolio. You as an individual investor, you're not constrained by that. You can buy and sell stocks or ETFs or mutual funds as you see fit. But just because you're in a managed fund doesn't mean that he can steer around the iceberg. All he can do is put on his life jacket and prepare to hit the iceberg. And I don't use that analogy facetiously. You see what I'm just describing now? That may be the underlying reason that we've seen stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the big blue chip stocks, the big S&P 500 stocks, the major technology stocks like Apple and Google, Microsoft. Perhaps the reason we've seen them growing so much this year, at the same time we've seen the smaller cap stocks, in many cases down by over 20%, the Russell 2000 index down significantly this year, about half the stocks in the NASDAQ down significantly. Not the big stocks, not the big, well-funded, highly capitalized stocks. They've done well. But the normal growth stocks, the places in the economy that you would expect to be a leading economic indicator, they've been declining all year. Again, if you look at these small cap stocks, many of them are 20% off their highs. That's not just a correction, that's a bear market. Now, why might that be? Could it be that these mutual funds that are managed by portfolio managers that are constrained and required to stay in equities, could it be that over the last 12 months, as retail investors had come into the market, they've been slowly selling off these small, riskier stocks? And again, because they're constrained, because they can't have a large cash position, they have to invest in something. They're putting their money in the blue chip stocks and the high dividend paying stocks because they see that iceberg, they know they're going to hit it, and they just want to hit it in a big battleship, and they want to be wearing their life preserver. I don't know if that's the case, and I'm not really hearing this being discussed in the mainstream news. But that's my theory. That's what I think perhaps could be going on. Now the question is, will they be able to weather the storm? Will they be able to hit that iceberg and survive because they're in these big battleships? Up till now, they've been able to. Up till now, while these small, riskier stocks have fallen, have gone into a correction, have gone into a 20% bear market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500, they are still pretty much at all-time highs. So they have been able to manage the storm. Can they get through this next one? Again, I have no way of knowing. I just don't take the chance. I've worked long and hard to build my portfolio, and so I don't take unnecessary risks if I don't have to. That's why I am not a proponent of buying and holding. I'm not going to put on my life jacket and just run full speed ahead into the iceberg. I'm going to take a cash position. I'll sit things out, and I'll hold on to my 2 or 3 or 4% profit. That's an advantage that I feel that we have as small individual investors. Now again, I'm not predicting anything. I'm not offering you advice or making any recommendations. I'm just trying to explain to you how I see things, what my impression is of this economy, and to give you just some idea, some general illustration of how I might be handling that. And then it's up to you, as an adult, to think and act and draw your own conclusions. Now, for those of you that might be skeptical, or this may have been the first time that you've heard that fund managers are constrained and they can't move to cash, don't take my word or anybody's word for anything. You have Google. You can go out and look things up on your own. I have an article in front of me from Reuters, and this came out, I don't know, sometime last year. I saved it because I try and do that when I see a golden piece of nugget out there in the media. This particular Reuters article interviewed an investment portfolio manager named Brian, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name exactly. I think it's Lazarishak, Brian Lazarishak. He manages a $37 million mid-cap fund called Chase. Now, $37 million, that's an incredibly small fund. And because it's such a small fund, and Brian is probably just such a great guy, he spoke the truth and the media happened to capture it. Again, that's kind of a rare golden nugget. When I see those things, I like to latch onto them and I save them, but sometimes I don't remember what file they're in and it's hard to find. But I was able to find this one today, because I was thinking about what's going on in the market and how these managers are constrained and how they can't get out of a market. And that's why they go to these big blue chip stocks for security. And sometimes they're wrong and it just causes a bigger crash. But what Brian says in this article, when they're talking about what I just mentioned about the ability to go to cash, the ability to protect your investment, to take profits and just ride out the storm. Brian's quoted as saying, and here it is, quote, "We don't have the ability to go to cash even if we wanted to," end quote. And again, it's what I mentioned. If a portfolio, a fund They're governed by legal documents, and those requirements are spelled out in a portfolio. So if you own a mutual fund, go and read that prospectus that they emailed you that you probably never looked at. See what the constraints are on that fund. See if they have to maintain a 10 or a 15 or a, you know, maybe no more than a 20% cash position. I'm again looking through a Reuters article, and I see another fund manager. I can't see his name here, but I see him being quoted as saying, his concerns about rich valuations have prompted him to raise levels of cash he holds in his portfolio to 15% of assets. That's the highest level allowed by his fund's prospectus. You see what I'm saying? Most of these guys, they can't go to more than 10 or 15% cash. And when he mentions valuations there, that's what I've been blogging about on my website, investablewealth.com, and what I've been talking about in this podcast as I try and explain to you stock prices. The price of a stock is based on its future earnings. It's always based on earnings expectations. And so you put a valuation on that because you don't know what the future holds. So maybe historically a valuation for a blue chip stock like on the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average, maybe that's 15 or 16 times earnings. So that would mean if the stock was only earning $1, the stock price would be $15 or $16 if it was a 16 times earnings. Right now we're seeing many of these blue chip stocks at historical highs. And the actual valuations are hard to determine because of the shenanigans they use with these corporate buybacks and all the different balance sheet engineerings they use. But we're probably looking at valuations at historical highs, 18, 19, maybe 20 times earnings. I did an episode the other day where I talked about 30% of the Dow Jones Industrial Average being above 20 times earnings. This could possibly be a result of these fund managers that have to stay in equities. They're moving into these blue chip stocks over the last 12 months, and they're trying to weather the storm there. Well, it may work out for them, but it might not. These stocks could revert to their historic means. If we have a reversion to the mean, even if earnings stay where they're at, these stocks could still drop from the 20 times earnings down to about 15 times earnings. And again, that could be the good news. That could be if earnings are maintained. As I've mentioned before, the rising dollar, the global slowdown, rising interest rates, these could all have a negative impact on corporate earnings. So in addition to seeing the valuations come down to more normal realistic ranges, maybe 15, 16 times earnings, we could also see the earnings declining. That would be the perfect storm. That could be what finally precipitates us seeing a correction in this marketplace, a better than 10% correction that we haven't seen for about 3 years. Are we going to have a correction? Are we going to see a bear market of maybe a 20% drop, something that statistically we're long overdue for? I have no way of knowing. And again, neither does anybody else. That's why you just have to be cautious. You have to be conscious of these things and take precautions. Well, that'll wrap it up for this episode. The markets are very volatile. Be cautious. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me at the website, wealthsteading.com. And as always, this is John Pugliano wishing you the very best of returns.